Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 resident. Welcome to the 42nd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. It's been a while. It's probably been about 2 weeks last I made a podcast, which is kind of unfortunate. It's just residency gets a little on the busy side, but I'm glad to be back again. And over the next few days, hopefully I should put out a couple of podcasts. So let's begin. In today's podcast, really, I'm just going to talk about the pharmacology of the eye. It's going to be a short podcast, but I'm just going to also try to integrate a few things from renal and from some other body systems. But I want to basically use this podcast to round up our discussion of neuropharmacology so that we know we're done with that permanently. So, the eye, really the drugs that work on the eye, there's not many of them. There's just a few high-yield things you want to know here and there. But I feel like this is something that occasionally like annoys people. So I'll try to make it as logical as possible so that it's very easy to remember. Really, eye pharmacology is not terrible. You just learn it in a logical fashion and it just sticks to your brain really well. So what if you got an exam question about a 70-year-old male that is losing central vision? What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about macular degeneration. Remember, in macular degeneration, you lose the central vision first, and then you lose the peripheral vision later. Okay, versus glaucoma, where you lose peripheral vision first, and then lose central vision later. Okay, and there are two types of macular degeneration, right? So there's the dry kind and the wet kind. The dry kind, basically the pathophysiology involves the deposition of something known as drusen, okay? It's like a yellowish kind of extracellular material. And for the most part, you really cannot treat dry ARMD. I mean, there are some things you can give in the literature, like you can give like vitamin E, you can give like antioxidants, you can give beta carotene, you can give zinc, but for the most part, it's not very treatable. Now, the wet kind of ARMD, this one is more dangerous, but it's actually treatable, right? So the thing that happens is that the thing that sort of destroys the eye is that you form all these new blood vessels, right? So the buzz phrase you're looking for in tests is a neovascularization. And those blood vessels are kind of fragile, right? So they bleed, and as they keep bleeding into the macula, you begin to run into trouble. So the thing is, there is this enzyme that makes new blood vessels. It's known as VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor. Okay, it helps you make new blood vessels. So if you know that VEGF helps you make new blood vessels, and it's these new blood vessels that are causing all these problems in wet ARMD, it should then make sense that you should try to inhibit VEGF, right? So you can give a patient monoclonal antibodies against VEGF, like bevacizumab and ranibizumab. Usually those drugs are given as intraocular formulations, so you literally inject it directly into the patient's eye. Now, the next topic I'll talk about is glaucoma, right? So in glaucoma, right, again, like I said earlier, you lose peripheral vision first, and then you lose central vision. And remember, it's associated with an increased optic cup to disc ratio, right? So classically, it's more than 50% on exams. And if you do some kind of tonometry, you note increased intraocular pressures, right? And don't forget some other high yield associations with glaucoma, especially this one, right? So steroids, actually, if you take steroids chronically, it actually does increase your risk of glaucoma. Remember, steroids do many bad things to you. They can cause like osteonecrosis of the hip, they can cause osteoporosis, right? So steroids can actually cause compression fractures of the vertebra. Remember, steroids can cause peptic ulcer disease, right? That's why if a patient needs to be placed on a steroid for more than 3 months, usually you place them on a PPI, okay? So just, and the osteoporosis link, that's why you have to place patients taking steroids chronically on bisphosphonates, right? As again, osteoporosis prophylaxis. So steroids can also cause glaucoma. That's why I'm mentioning them in this context. Now, before we talk about the pharmacology of glaucoma, I need to talk about some quick eye anatomy, right? So the thing is, the eye has two big sections, okay? There's a posterior segment and there's an anterior segment, okay? The posterior, the thing that, the divisor between the posterior segment of the eye and the anterior segment of the eye is the lens, okay? The posterior segment of the eye lies behind the lens. The anterior segment lies in front of the lens. Okay, and in the posterior segment, that's where you make vitreous humor. Now, In the anterior segments, there are two sub-compartments, okay? So again, I said there's a posterior segment, there's an anterior segment. The anterior segment has two compartments. It has a posterior chamber and an anterior chamber. I know it's annoying, but it's something that's high yield to know. So posterior segment, anterior segment. Anterior segment has a posterior chamber and an anterior chamber. Now, the thing that divides the anterior and posterior subcomponents of the anterior segment is the iris. So the iris, the posterior chamber of the anterior segment is behind the iris. The anterior chamber of the anterior segment is in front of the iris. Now, there's a special population of cells known as the ciliary body. They rest in the posterior chamber of the anterior segment. The ciliary body makes aqueous humor, okay? And it makes it through an enzyme known as carbonic anhydrase. Okay, now carbonic anhydrase, hopefully you remember that it's one of those high yield enzymes that operates at the proximal convoluted tubule of the nephron. Okay, remember that's what's inhibited by carbonic anhydrase inhibitors like acetazolamide and dorzolamide. And remember, those are all sulfur drugs, right? And don't forget osteopetrosis, right? It's associated, it's like an osteoclast defect, is associated with a mutation in carbonic anhydrase 2. That's the disease you treat with interferon gamma. Okay, so carbonic anhydrase is one of the big enzymes you need to make aqueous humor from the ciliary body, which is part of the posterior chamber of the anterior segment. And this production is actually stimulated by the activation of beta 2 receptors. Remember, those are adrenergic receptors. Now, when you make the aqueous humor in the posterior chamber of the eye, okay, it flows around past the iris, okay, and it then drains through the canal of Schlemm. The thing is, the canal of Schlemm is a blood vessel, okay, so because it's a blood vessel, it can be acted upon by vasoactive agents. You'll see what I mean as we proceed further. Now, one other thing you want to know is that the ciliary body, when it, for the pupil, whenever you have constriction of the pupil, you actually draw the iris away from the cornea, and that actually promotes drainage through the canal of Schlemm. So that is the angle that they refer to when they are talking about glaucoma, is the angle between the cornea and the lens. Okay, that angle, you can decrease that angle and decrease drainage of the canal through the canal of Schlemm by causing mydriasis, pupillary dilation. But if you had pupillary constriction, aka meiosis, and you made the pupil smaller, okay, that would increase the angle and that would increase drainage through the canal of Schlemm. So in open angle glaucoma, right, so this is classically in an older person, African Americans, they actually have a pretty high risk. And the pathogenesis, really, of open angle glaucoma is you're either making too much aqueous humor or you're having too little drainage of aqueous humor, right? So think of it as either a production problem, you're making too much, or a drainage problem, right? So the works have been clogged up, so you're not draining things as well. So now let's talk about glaucoma drugs. Really, if you understand all these things I've mentioned, the drugs make a lot of sense, right? So I already said that beta 2 receptors, right, when you activate them, the beta 2 receptors on the ciliary epithelium, you begin to make a ton of aqueous humor. So if you wanted to treat glaucoma, you'd want to go ahead and block those beta 2 receptors, right? And you can use drugs like timolol and nidolol. Okay, those are non-selective beta blockers, okay, but they can also act on beta 2 receptors. So by blocking those beta 2 receptors, they decrease the production of aqueous humor. Now, some other drugs that are also used that are beta blockers are acebutolol and pindolol. But hopefully you've not forgotten from the adrenergic pharmacology podcasts that, autonomic pharmacology podcasts, that these drugs are actually partial beta agonists. Okay, so the thing is, in the presence of norepinephrine, it's like they're stealing norepinephrine's thunder, if you may, because if you had norepinephrine around, it will exert the full, or I guess epinephrine, since we're talking about beta 2 receptors, because norepinephrine really has no effects on beta 2 receptors. So if you have full epinephrine around, it activates those beta 2 receptors, you get full epinephrine effect. But if these guys like acebutolol and pindolol are hanging out on the beta 2 receptor, you're getting a partial effect. You're not getting the full effect. So it's like you're having a reversal if you may, like a functional reversal of the effects of epinephrine. So that is a blockade, relatively. Okay, so these partial beta 2 agonists are actually pretty good beta blockers, and again, they are used for glaucoma. So drugs like acebutolol and pindolol. Now, alpha 2 agonists can actually be used to treat glaucoma as well. So you may say, come on, Divine, this doesn't make any sense. Alpha 2 agonists, is that not an adrenergic receptor? Is that not an activating business? Well, if you step back to the Autonomic Pharmacology podcast, you may remember that I said that alpha 2 receptors are GI coupled. Okay, so it's an inhibitory G protein that's coupled to the receptor. So if you activate that alpha 2 receptor, okay, you actually cause an inhibition of adenylate cyclase. Okay, and by inhibiting adenylate cyclase, you actually have less release of norepinephrine at the adrenergic synapse. So think about it. If you are releasing less catecholamine at the adrenergic synapse, you can already begin to imagine that you have less of an agonist available for the activation of beta 2 receptors. And really, I think for this, I would say that beta 2 in fact, let me call back something I've said. So if you notice, I've been saying that for the ciliary epithelium, you have beta 2 receptors. If I'm not mistaken, so I'll have to look this up, so I may correct this in a later podcast. I believe there is actually beta 1 receptors as well on the surfaces, on the cell membranes of the ciliary epithelium. Okay, so don't think just beta 2 receptors. Also think of beta 1 receptors. I'll check on that and get back to you, to whoever is listening to this, in a later podcast. But I'm almost certain that's the case. So, if you activate alpha 2 receptors, you decrease less norepinephrine. Remember, those alpha 2 receptors are a negative feedback system for the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so you activate those, you release less norepinephrine, so you have less activation of the beta receptors on the ciliary epithelium. If you have less activation, you produce less aqueous humor. So that's how drugs like apraclonidine and brimonidine work. And if you really sound out the names of these drugs, if you notice, they all end in dine, just like clonidine, right? Clonidine is a blood pressure med that works by activating alpha 2 receptors because it causes a decreased release of norepinephrine. Now, the next set of drugs I want to talk about are the carbonic anhydrase inhibitors. The big one I want to mention here is acetazolamide, okay? Acetazolamide is a ubiquitous drug. It can work for many, many, many things, okay? One thing you can use acetazolamide for is for the treatment of glaucoma, right? I mean, I'm talking about glaucoma now, right? So that should make sense. And again, by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase, you're inhibiting one of the enzymes necessary for the production of aqueous humor. So you have a decreased production of aqueous humor. Now, some other high yield things here. Acetazolamide is actually used also to treat idiopathic intracranial hypertension, okay? Also known as pseudotumor cerebral, right? So remember, if a patient has IIH, they have like too much CSF basically in their ventricular systems, right? And it can cause trouble, right? So classically on exams, they'll tell you about like a young female, like a 20s, 30s, or early 40s that has a high BMI, so like 35, and they could tell you that, oh, she takes vitamin A, or she's being treated for acne with like a vitamin A derivative, and she has like eye pain, she has like headaches, like a chronic headaches, and they tell you, oh, you do a physical fundoscopic exam and you observe papilledema, right? So that's pretty classic for idiopathic intracranial hypertension. So if you know that too much CSF and elevated CSF pressures are implicated in the pathophysiology of this disorder, you can try to kill an enzyme that is necessary for the production of CSF, like carbonic anhydrase. Another thing you could also do for these patients is to do like a large serial lumbar punctures to just drain off some of that fluid. Now, another thing you can use acetazolamide for is altitude sickness, right? So let's think about some physiology here. If you go to higher elevations, right, what happens to your O2 tension, your oxygen tension? It should decrease, right? Because yes, your FiO2 is not going down. It's still like 21%. But remember, the higher you go, the less the atmospheric pressure, right? So as you go higher in the atmosphere, atmospheric pressures go down. So if you're taking 21% of like 700 as against 21% of 760, you can already begin to see that you have a decreased oxygen tension as you go higher, right? So because the oxygen tension in the atmosphere decreases as you go higher, right, to higher elevations, you begin to get hypoxic, right? And the way your body tries to respond to that is by encouraging hyperventilation. Now, if you hyperventilate, you're blowing off a ton of CO2, right? So that causes a respiratory alkalosis, okay? Causes a respiratory alkalosis. Now, the thing is, your body will take a few days to try to compensate for that respiratory alkalosis. Remember, your body will compensate for that respiratory alkalosis with a metabolic acidosis. You can speed that compensatory process along by giving acetazolamide. Remember, by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule, you do not reclaim bicarb at the PCT. So that bicarb is dumped in the urine. When you dump it in the urine, you actually create metabolic acidosis as a side effect. In fact, remember that acetazolamide is one of the few diuretic. In fact, it's probably like the only high-yield diuretic that causes a metabolic acidosis as a side effect with a concomitant hypokalemia. That is very rare, right? Because most of the other diuretics cause metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia. So you use the metabolic acidosis side effect of acetazolamide to make that compensation by the kidneys faster, okay, so that you can create that metabolic acidosis to compensate for the respiratory alkalosis that you get from hyperventilating to bring in as much oxygen as possible. Now, remember again, they could make this like a nifty question on a test, right? So acetazolamide, basically, by virtue of its mechanism of action, causes a type 2 renal tubular acidosis, right? Because again, it's acting at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule. So it's causing a proximal RTA, which is a type 2 RTA. Now, one other high yield thing you probably want to know about actually a few more high yield things you want to know about acetazolamide. One is that it can actually be used to treat central sleep apnea. So the thing is, I always wondered, like, why is that the case? The thing is, I really have not found any convincing explanations online, but, or in, like in papers or whatever, but there is something that makes teleologic sense to me. So I'm going to try to explain it in that context. So I already said that acetazolamide inhibits carbonic anhydrase, right? So if you inhibit a carbonic anhydrase, I already told you that you'll get a metabolic acidosis because you are dumping a lot of bicarb in the urine. Now, think about it. When you get a metabolic acidosis, how does your body try to compensate? Well, I hope you're thinking that it compensates with a respiratory alkalosis. And to achieve that respiratory alkalosis, what do you need to do? You need to hyperventilate, right? So if a patient has a central sleep apnea where they have like a decreased respiratory drive, you could try with acetazolamide to essentially create an acid-base deficit that will force the body to hyperventilate as a compensatory response. So that's my teleologic means of understanding why acetazolamide could potentially be used for the treatment of central sleep apnea. Now, other high yield things with acetazolamide, right? So you probably know about cystinuria, okay? It's like a defect in CoA transporters at the level of the nephron. The level of the proximal convoluted tubule, right? So remember, CoA, the C stands for cysteine, the O stands for ornithine, okay? The L stands for lysine, and the A stands for arginine. Remember, arginine is used to make nitric oxide. Now, those things, because that transporter doesn't work, they all show up in the urine, okay? Now, the thing is, cysteine can form kidney stones, okay? Remember, it's the kidney stone that looks like a benzene ring. It's a six-membered ring. In fact, there's this fancy mnemonic you've probably heard of as you're studying, that cysteine sounds like 16, okay? To help you remember that cysteine stones are shaped like a benzene ring. Now, so they are hexagonal crystals. So the thing is, these cysteine stones, you can actually increase, like you could actually like dissolve them in the urine and sort of like prevent a kidney stone, if you may, by alkalinizing the urine. Now, by virtue of acetazolamide's mechanism of action, right, it can alkalinize the urine. When you alkalinize that urine, you basically increase the pH of urine, and by doing that, you can dissolve those cysteine stones. Now, also don't forget that acetazolamide is a sulfur drug, right? So if a patient has a sulfur allergy, no acetazolamide. The high-yield diuretic you probably want to know about that is not a sulfur drug is the loop diuretic ethacrynic acid. Okay, it's just it's not used very commonly because it's ototoxic. Now, also don't forget that if a patient has like a Proteus mirabilis UTI, for example, remember Proteus is a urease positive bug, acetazolamide could technically worsen that, right? Because again, it raises the urine pH by dumping more bicarb in the urine because it's inhibiting carbonic anhydrase. Now, the last set of drugs I'm going to talk about are the prostaglandin analogs, okay? So these drugs all end in prost, right? So like latanoprost, travoprost, bimatoprost, they are all used for the treatment of glaucoma. The thing is, again, I mentioned earlier that the canal of Schlemm is a blood vessel, okay? So if you give a prostaglandin analog, remember prostaglandins cause vasodilation, you can dilate that canal of Schlemm and promote the drainage of aqueous humor. Okay, the big side effects you want to know with these drugs are that they can cause like a discoloration of the eyelids. Okay, they can cause like a discoloration, or they can cause like thickening of the eyelashes. Okay, so just sort of keep that thing in mind. Now, whoops, I made a mistake. So, just some real quick things. I guess I will go ahead and talk about like closed angle glaucoma, right? So, closed angle glaucoma, basically, if you have anything that suddenly dilates your pupil. Okay, say for example you go to the movies, and in the movies, right, because of the let's say you step out into the light, right, for example, right, so if light is shown in your eye, right, you have like pupillary constriction, right, and then let's say you then go into darkness, and then you open that darkness you're getting into causes pupillary dilation. That can acutely narrow the angle between the iris and the cornea, okay? And that can trigger a closed angle glaucoma. Classically on exams, it's in young Asians, okay? So, so for closed angle glaucoma, what could you do, right? So you could give acetazolamide, although that's it's probably not first line. But there are other things you could do, right? Classically on exams, you do like a laser iridotomy. So you basically use like lasers to burst holes in the iris so that you can promote drainage of that aqueous humor. But another thing you can do is you can actually give muscarinic agonists, right? Because muscarinic agonists, they cause pupillary meiosis, right? So pupillary constriction. So that increases that angle between the iris and the cornea so that you have better drainage through the canal of Schlemm. And don't forget that closed angle glaucoma classically shows up as a rock hard eye in a patient with nausea and vomiting on tests. So that is where I'm going to end today. Thank you for listening. I will hopefully make a 43rd podcast soon. I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful month and God bless. Thank you.